Listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is the Motley Fool Money Mailbag.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our very special Sunday mailbag edition, where I play the role of Scott Phillips and he plays the role of Andrew Page Esquire, the founder, managing director, chief cook and bottle washer of strawman.com. Mr. Page, good morning.
Good morning. I like to think I play the role better than anyone else.
I certainly play it more iconoclastically than anyone else. I could say that for sure. Is that a reasonable thing to say?
Well, I just mean that, like, if you're going to play someone, playing yourself is probably the safest bet. You know, you can't be wrong, right?
So if you're under that convincingly, you've got some trouble. That's a
whatever I do, I'm going to do a good job of it. So
very, very good. Mate, you're well, I assume, this Sunday morning?
Yes. You know, I've done the jog, done the climb, done the
good
weights.
The pentathlon, the usual pentathlon.
Six-pack of beer before nine, sure. You name it.
All the good things. All mate, good things. We got a heap of questions, so let's get straight into them this week. We kind of foreshadowed this one on Friday's podcast. Basically, Brandon says, I can't send this to Ram, though I'd love to get his rant, sorry, I mean thoughts, on the mascot towers, fiasco and deal. By which I replied, oh man, you really want to wind him up. And he says, Bitcoin and property. But on a serious note, the 40% mortgage reduction agreed to by the banks and then covering whatever, if any, by the government would have to be quite a unique situation, right? And I thought this was worth talking about, mate. We're not going to do this in heaps of detail because it's a bit complex and the numbers are weird and it's only a very specific circumstance. But I think there probably is some implication, or at least some things worth thinking about. So Mascot Towers, big tower block in Sydney. Mascot is in the kind of inner south of Sydney, near the airport, obviously, for those who know that. It seems like the owners have come to a deal. And the deal is between the banks, the government, and a prospective owner to kind of basically make this thing go away. However, still saying there is that they'll probably still end up being worse off as a result. They haven't been able to move in. This thing's been empty since 2019. Wow. So let's go through quickly what it is, and then I'll get your thoughts about it. So basically, a few things going on. Firstly, the government is going to give support for investors and owner-occupiers without mortgages. The government's offering a means-tested support payment of up to 120 grand. Owner-occupiers over 65 will get up to $360,000 in means-tested government support. The government has basically twisted the arms of the banks to take 40% of their loan away, their mortgage, and some buyer is going to basically buy the whole block for about $30 million, which would give every owner about 212 odd grand per unit to basically vacate the place. And I assume the owner, or the new owner, the prospective owner, has to pay such a low price because there's so much work to be done that it's going to have to be done. Now, here's the quote from the ABC article. It just says, quote, one owner contacted by the ABC who stands to lose up to $2 million said they were glad your deal would be over, end quote. I will throw in another one in. One of the experts discussing this one says, quote, has described the Mascot Towers fiasco as a perfect storm of regulatory, systemic, and system-wide failure, end quote. Mm-hmm. Now, he then goes to say he did not believe the situation as dire would happen again in New South Wales. The article says the government has introduced a string of stricter building regulations, including latent defects insurance, which is intended to cover owners' costs of fixing building defects for up to 10 years. And in Brandon's, if I inhabit Brandon's thoughts for a second, I'll simply ask you what he asked me, which is to get your thoughts on what you think about the entire fiasco and deal.
Yeah. Well, first off, my heart really goes out to the people affected. Like, it's a tragedy, and it's more than just a financial conversation. You know, it's people's life savings, and it breaks my heart. I can't imagine going through that for 5 years, you know, with so much uncertainty. And I'm kind of the view that if we've got the means and as a society to sort of help people who fall victim to these kinds of things out, then yeah, I'm happy with that. It does create, but again, it always comes back to the incentives at play. It creates a very slippery slope if the government is going to bail out anyone who finds themselves in this situation. It's a moral hazard of sorts for developers in the sense that they can just continue to build at subpar standards and know that there'll be someone else that foots the bill. And in that case, when it becomes more of a problem, I'm like, well, actually, do I want all these tax dollars, you know, being spent over here? I think that the easiest and most obvious solution is that there must be a warranty of sorts. I know you mentioned the insurance, but I would much prefer a warranty of sorts on the personal assets of the developers. In Roman, let me give you a story. In Roman times,
settle in, kids. Uncle Rand's going to tell you a story.
In the beginning, back in Roman times, the chief architect of any project, or of any, I think the arch was the example, but they had to be standing under the arch when they removed the scaffolding, when they placed the keystone. This actually happened. Because if the arch wasn't held, if the building wasn't sound, it would collapse and it would kill them. Now, very occasionally, there was a tragic accident as a result of that. But let me tell you, many of those arches are standing today. Right? And
there might have been more built if there were more architects. I imagine the supply of architects kind of waxed and waned from time to time.
Well, here's the thing. It hardly ever happened, right? And the podcast that I'm basing this off, I think could actually find one like legitimate verified record of it actually happening. But we do know that the Romans build incredible things and they around today. I don't think an apartment building going up in Sydney is going to be around in 2,000 years' time, just quietly, let alone 20 years. It ain't going to happen. And I know it's sort of a bit of a silly example, but at the same time, I think that's what it has to be. You can have all the regulations and rules in place, but when your own bum is on the line, you're going to try a lot harder. The retort would be, well, that's unviable. No one can do that in that case. And I call BS on that. It's like, you know, not open up a can of worms, not giving public funding to private schools. There will still be private schools, right? I'll call that bluff any day of the week because it might actually increase prices for housing, and that would be not a great thing.
Right,
but
that's the unintended consequences problem.
Exactly, it's the unintended consequence, but there is a real cost. Money represents real limitations and things, right? And if that's what it costs to have, I would rather pay higher for a high quality house than less for another one that when I amortize that over the full length of its useful life and I factor in maintenance and the rest of it, it's a false economy. These houses look cheaper than the price tag suggests when you factor in all of the remediation, all the fixing, everything else. And even just in more recent times, you walk around the streets of Sydney, you see these beautiful Art Deco places built in the 70s. And the windows are old, but you know, things are a bit worn, but they are built like a tank, those things. And you see places built in 2012, which are already falling to pieces. And the incentives in the industry are, I said to you off air, in fact, you know, it's just like, just build it and flick it, build it and flick it. Doesn't really matter. It's not my problems. I can sort of dust my hands, take the profit and move on. And there's no personal consequences. So, you know, you can achieve perhaps the same thing with more regulation and maintenance. I'm not saying we don't do that, but I think that sometimes the most obvious, elegant solution, and I say this knowing it's never going to happen, people, but I would do that. I would sort of say, as a developer, you've got to pay a bond or something. I call it a warranty in general terms, such that if 5 years later, or frankly 10 years later, depending on what the defect is, if I'm living in a place and there's something wrong, there is recourse to be had. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that's a perfect solution in theory. I think that if you're building a tower, so they're going to sell it for $30 million, which is something under the cost or of putting it up. Maybe it costs $100 million. Is $100 million of assets anywhere that someone's going to risk to put up a tower up? No. Does the tower then not get built? I don't know. We're talking on Friday about unintended consequences, mate. I think that's a perfect solution. I'm not sure whether it's workable, given we've talked a lot about supply and demand in housing recently, but would we have enough dwellings built on that basis? I don't know. What I do love is your total cost of ownership idea, mate. And we've talked about cast iron pans and R.M. Williams boots and frankly, you know, the whole Tesla thing. I don't own an EV. I might buy one at some point soon. Not soon, but you know, in the foreseeable future, 10 years, something. The total cost of ownership of those things is much lower once you drive it off the lot than a car with an internal combustion engine. And yet, the consumer making the choice, you know, you paid, we're going to pay extra 10, 20 grand for 10, 12 grand for that car maybe not. You know, there is a real, as humans, we're not very good at the long-term costs of these things. I think if we paid a lot more attention, I've for a long time said, you know, double glazing or solar panels on the roofs for new houses, it just makes perfect sense, right? So, oh, it's going to add $10,000 to the price. And they're right. They're absolutely right. Mm. A reasonable person would say, but I'm going to pay so much less for electricity or whatever those things, insulation, those kind of things, right? It just makes perfect sense. Right, exactly.
It's cheaper. Is the short answer is it's
yes.
cheaper.
Yes, over the cost of ownership. But. Yep,
yeah.
yep.
But still, do you plan on owning it for like 3 days or do you plan on owning it for like 30 years? Like,
and yet it's just human nature. Like I think that's where I have some sympathy for those people who don't get it because it's hard to get, like get properly. You know, is it someone said, here's the numbers, like, okay, I understand, yeah, sure. But am I going to still pay that money? It's a really human thing to say the upfront cost is scary as hell. We've heard about stamp duty and land tax, same kind of thing. We've talked about these so many times before. It's just a real thing. So, yeah, I just want to throw those out as additional thoughts.
Yep.
I don't disagree with you, mate. I think the only reason I think insurance might work is because of the ability to pull those costs and have that insurance met. I guess
I'm just thinking, properly structured insurance scheme.
Right, actual insurance run by a proper insurer, with premiums set properly, that is mandatory for the builder. I think that's...
Yes.
Again, you're not wrong that it should be personal assets because it would focus the mind. The reality well, no builder would have any assets, right? It'd be in the name of the husband or the wife or you know, something else. The company would go broke and also there'd be no assets to call on. We all know, we've seen that happen so many times. So I think in theory, you're... The angle you take in terms of human nature and human behavior is spot on. We also know the incentives. The other side of that is that all of a sudden there'd be a whole lot of builders with no assets to their names all of a sudden.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, well, one day when I'm Lord of Australia, it'll happen. But until then, perfect is the enemy of the good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mate, interesting question. We're getting very philosophical very early in this podcast, maybe appropriately. This is from Trade Tornado on Twitter. Now, hey, Scott and Andrew. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this idea. It's about the growing trend of younger Australians considering packing their bags and setting up shop in another country instead of staying put in Australia. With the way house prices are skyrocketing, buying a home here is now essentially a pipe dream for most of us. It's a lot of pressure and it's not just about money. It's affecting our mental health, our relationships and more. It got me thinking, are the cons outweighing the pros of staying in Australia? Australia has always been seen as the lucky country, says Trade Tornado, with top-notch living standards, healthcare, and education. But now it seems like other countries, which weren't so lucky before, are stepping up their game. Take Japan, for instance, where you can get a home for way less than what you'd pay in our capital cities. And with today's digital world, working remotely from places like Singapore, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, or even Thailand, Vietnam, and Bali are becoming a real possibility. These places might not have the healthcare and safety nets we're used to, but then again, is depending too much on the government really the way to go? As a small business owner, he says, I'm feeling the pinch too. Running a business here comes with a hefty price tag, thanks to all the regulations, licensing fees, and taxes. It's like you're being penalized for wanting to do your own thing. The alternative?
I love it. Give me more of this. Straight into the veins. I'm loving everything.
The alternative? A soul-sucking 9-to-5 job, which doesn't sound any better. I'm curious about your take on this whole idea of young Australians moving overseas for a better life. It seems many have already made the move and haven't looked back. Thanks for keeping the podcast awesome as always and keen to hear your thoughts. Cheers, Trade Tornado. You know what I find interesting about this one? I'm just going to set this up and ask you your thoughts, man. I'll weigh in afterwards.
Okay.
There is a very clear problem being illustrated and then a single outcome. I don't know your view. I don't even have necessarily a firm view other than to say the problem can be real without the suggested solution being the right one, potentially, or maybe not. What do you think, mate?
Oh, God, I love that question. That's question of the year so far. I loved it. Well, the answer is it's a personal choice. So I can't dictate whether that's what people should do. People will do it if they feel it's appropriate. But I would say what you can say objectively is that there's a sacrifice to moving away from home and your family network and your social network and to areas that don't have the same kind of social services that you might be used to. I mean, there is a big cost to that. But as Trade Tornado rightly points out, there's trade-offs across the board. And it is becoming increasingly more tenable to make some of those sacrifices if it means that you can have a nice house without massive debt and huge financial pressure. I can speak from it very personally. We very seriously were looking at Adelaide for a time there. And I love Adelaide. I got nothing bad to say about it, right? We were thinking of sort of going there, but it would have been a big sacrifice. Mm. The only reason was just because Sydney was just untenable.
Yeah.
And I think that over time, particularly with the increased capacity to work anywhere, as long as you've got an internet access, I think people will do it. And we've seen it locally. We've seen a lot of emigration from Sydney to Brisbane and Melbourne and Canberra and particularly Newcastle and Wollongong, increasingly the Blue Mountains.
Sea change stuff. Yeah, exactly.
It's driving people out to where if they housing was half the price, they wouldn't be. You know what I mean? So yeah, I think it's a real thing. And let me just give a quick shout out to it is really tough. As anyone listening to this has ever run their own business, how difficult and unnecessarily difficult things get made. And you do often at times just go, why don't I just go to get a 9-to-5 job at an employer? Because these become much more pointy sort of questions, I think, when you're in that situation. So anyway, what do you think?
I think the issues are
You're on mute. Sorry, mate.
I think the issues are very real. I wonder whether we're all biased. It would take a lot for me to move out of Australia for family, social, emotional, whatever reasons, right? And for the safety nets and other things that Trades on Earth talks about. I'm kind of stuck with. We have to solve the problems. Do I think my life would be meaningfully better if I was a young person? I moved to some of those places. Don't know. I mean, people over there live in those places and love it. So I'm not going to say no.
That's what I say. It's a personal thing. It's not about you or me. You know, it's like more. I just think for more people, it will be. And it is. We can see factually, like right now, and look back over recent years, like there's been an increasing number of people that do that.
Yeah.
And will that continue? I think it kind of does. And I think sorry to cut you off, but I think it's a very different question when it's a live question and it's not a theoretical question.
Yeah,
like exactly. When you're in that situation, exactly. Yes, 20, you don't have kids, you've got a lot of flexibility, you can work anywhere you want. It's sort of like, oh man, rent is bleeding me out and I can't even have a dishwasher that works or a light that turns
exactly,
on.
Exactly.
Or I can live on the beach in Bali.
Right.
I might do, even it's like a permanent thing, right? Like just see it's a different question when you're there, and that's a real live option.
So, yeah, I don't know, mate. I think, as you say, it's hard. It's absolutely a personal question. It would take me a lot to move. I think we have I'm not saying this about Trade Tornado at all, but it's really, really easy to take things we have for granted when we focus only on the things we wish were better or different. Mm. So, safety. Literal physical safety net, rule of law, language, family, environment. I'm sitting here, it's a beautiful sunny day as we record this. It wasn't yesterday, so it's not always, but you know, the freedoms that we have, the society that we live in. Other places are better till they're not, and maybe they always are better, or maybe they're always no worse, and that's fine too. If you think about the rest of the world and think who's killing, people in some of those countries to fall over themselves to get to Australia. And we're looking at going, oh, it'd be good to be over there. Sometimes the grass is greener. What I despair about is that to the point of the question of people are making this decision because they feel like there's no other option in Australia left.
It's forced. Your hand is forced. I think that's the crux. Sorry, just to clarify, I think that's the crux of it. It's not like if I had the means to live in a city, Sydney, you know, and still have plenty of discretionary income afterwards to enjoy my life. But hell yeah, you know, I'm not even contemplating Thailand.
Right.
But it's only in the context of I'm living in a shoebox that's full of black mold, and I'm working my fingers to the bone, and I'm eating 2-minute noodles just to pay the rent. That's a different question.
Exactly. So yeah, mate, it's tough. I don't know what. I'm not gonna tell them what they should do. I think I'll do the politician thing and say I don't accept the premise of the question. In other words, we should actually fix the problems, right? Rather than have to say, so this is really rubbish. Should I leave or go? So I'll live or stay. We should be saying this is really rubbish. We shouldn't have to have that question. And it doesn't solve the problem for people in that situation because they can't make it change anytime soon. But yep. the rest of us, those of us with any sort of opportunity to influence these things, probably have a reasonably significant responsibility to kind of make the place a bit better and solve some of those problems so people don't have to make those choices. That would be a nice start. And there's lots of, by the way, issues. I guess the other thing, the point I was making about, you know, part of why I think it's so expensive, part of it is massive immigration, in which case you're kind of back to that point I made before about a whole lot of people wanting to be here and some of our people thinking about leaving. It's like, something's really wrong here. You know, if people are saying, I desperately want to go to Australia, and a whole lot of people saying, well, I think I might leave, we're getting something pretty wrong.
Well, as an interesting data point to that, there was an article a couple of weeks ago, like I think particularly students from India who had come over for all of the great things that we have to offer here, but actually found that, no, I've got a better deal at home.
Yeah.
Right? So
yes, that's right.
Like, it's a thing. And and just for fun in the past, you know, over the years, I've looked into it, right? Like, just, I'm never going to convince the wife, right? Like,
exactly.
Not going to happen. But you do look at, I mean, Thailand is interesting. Vietnam's another interesting one as well. There's actually some reason. I mean, unfortunately, in those places, you have to have a fair degree of wealth to access those services. But if you have that wealth, then you have those services. And the wealth that you might pick up from here and plant down there, and again, particularly if you can maintain your Australian wage or Australian income ability, you actually find yourself in the top 5% without having to be a surgeon or investment banker or whatever. And so as I say, it's not going to happen, but you sort of look at it and go, wow, we could have that house with access to all of these services. And it'd be a change, but it'd also be an adventure, right? Like, and as I say, it's all sort of a dreamy sort of thought bubbly kind of thing until it's sort of like, I'm moving into my 8th house in 12 years here and I just can't get ahead. And so that for me, I see it as a phenomenon where more people will absolutely do it.
I think that's true.
Because they've got no choice. Unless they want to hope that someone fixes it and fixes it soon.
Correct. I guess my only point is, and again, nothing against Thailand or Vietnam, any of those countries you mentioned, mate, but you move there and live in the top 5%, but you're still in the top 5% of those countries, which you have to be comfortable with as an idea. It's like people who say, I'd rather be King George V than, or 8th, or Henry VIII, or whatever else, than poor today. It's like, well, be careful what you wish for, because in a relative sense, you're much richer than anybody else. You still have a worse standard of living than here.
That's a good point.
It's true of those places, just that you go and they go, hey, I'm rich and I've got no friends and I don't really like the country and I don't feel safe. And again, I'm not saying that is the case for anything about this other than, I will use PNG for an example. I've been to Port Moresby. It is a very difficult place to imagine living. Now, if I had more money than God, could I live there? Yes,
with it's security a spectrum, guards
and
right?
security and whatever. Yeah. But yeah, exactly. It's where, what do you
there's want? Some places are just like really, I'm not going to North Korea, right? Anytime soon.
Yes.
But you know, I mean, some of the Asian countries, they've developed a lot. They had some of the strongest growth. Anyway, but I mean, we're arguing, we're splitting hairs at this point in time.
Yeah. Mate, Steve asked a question. He says, so hi, Scott and Andrew, I love the podcast. And I enjoy trying to predict what Andrew will say about property, financial advisors, and boomers. And then in brackets says, none taken, Andrew. I assume Steve might be a boomer. I'm an old boomer in retirement. Sorry, Steve. On Andrew's behalf, I apologize, Steve, for all the horrible things he said about you personally. I'm an old boomer in retirement, says Steve. And I'm mainly into dividend shares, and it seems to be working well. For years, I tried trading. He says in brackets, I didn't call it that. I just simply bought high and sold low. I love it. In short, I've done all the dumb things. God, that'd be a good song. In recent years, I've listened carefully to what you say about value and time in the market. I now look at the price earnings ratio, the price to book ratio, and earnings per share, as I think these are good fundamentals. These days, I also look at percentage in cash, as I think it helps to find companies that can ride out the storm. He says in brackets, and still pay dividends, in close brackets.
Yeah, nice.
Recently, you spoke about enterprise value, which I like the sound of, but I have trouble finding it. I use CommSec, he says, and it's not in the data there. I Googled EV and had to go up trying to calculate it myself, but I'm not sure if I'm getting it right. Even if I am, I'm really not sure what good is
what is
a good EV?
Yeah.
Even though I'm mainly in dividend shares, I still invest in some potential growth stocks, but not more than I can afford to take a loss on. Recently, I bought some Kingston. Everything I thought I knew from listening to you guys is that Kingston should be doing great. PE under 4, price to book of less than half, and an earnings per share of almost 30%. I don't know what maybe earnings yield he might be talking about, I think, rather than EPS. I think it also has an enterprise value of about 7, but I don't know if that's good. Earnings growth is predicted at 6 cents in 2024. That's 75% of its current price. I suppose this is one of those "what am I missing?" questions. Seems too good to be true, and that makes me nervous. Or is it simply one of those "the market is stupid" things that Andrew mentions occasionally? One of the things that makes me feel that everyone else knows something that I don't is that there are far more sellers than buyers. Is this something I should watch? I know you don't give personal advice, but this one share makes me think everything I thought I learned is unreliable or wrong. Thanks again. Love the laughs and the frankness. And that's from Steve. Let's try and get this in some sort of order, mate. Can we go with EV? Enterprise value itself isn't a metric. It's a calculation. I don't know if he's comparing it. When he says an EV of 7, I assume he means EV to EBITDA of 7. But let's just kind of explain EV and then EV to EBITDA, mate, if you would.
Yeah. So you may have heard of market capitalization, which is you just take the number of shares and you times it by the share price. So it says if you want to buy up all of this company, this is how much the market is currently telling you that it's worth.
How much you have to pay, yep.
Yep. What it doesn't tell you is the capital structure of the business. So you and I might have identical businesses. Mm-hmm. I might have a huge amount of debt on the balance sheet,
right,
and you might have no debt and a massive pile of cash.
So we've both got 10 shares in our company. They're selling for $1 each. So my market capitalization is $10 and your market capitalization is $10.
Yep.
But the balance sheets are really, really, really different.
Really different. So when you're looking at valuing a business or saying how much is the business worth aside from, because I, in theory, after the fact, I can always change the capital structure. Mm-hmm. If I'm bringing enough capital to this deal, I can pay down the debt. Or if I'm buying it with a company with a lot of cash, I can buy it and then take that cash and just put it in my pocket. I can do whatever I like with it. So what I'm trying to get to with enterprise value is I'm trying to get to a view of like, what is the value of the enterprise, you know, of the economic entity that is generating a profit, or hopefully generating a profit. So what I do is I take away debt I add debt and I take away cash. So the calculation, to your point, is super easy. Start with the market capitalization, add the debt, add all of the debt that they owe to someone else, and then take away all of the unencumbered cash that they have themselves. Right. And that says with like sort of like being agnostic to the balance sheet. If I just wanted to buy all of the, let's keep it simple and say sort of factories and the machinery and the intellectual property and the lease obligations and everything that I'm going to need to actually churn out whatever widget this thing is churning out, what does that cost? That's enterprise value.
Yep. The value of the enterprise itself. I'm just going to put some numbers on it, mate, very quickly to use my example from before. You and I both have a market cap of $10. I can't remember who you said who had the debt, so I'll say me. I've got $5 of debt in my business. So if you wanted to buy the business and then pay off the debt, so you're just looking at the business itself without the capital structure, you have to pay $15. $10 to buy it and $5 more to pay off the debt. So the enterprise value of my business is $15. Now, if Ram's got a business that's got a market cap of $10, but he's got $5 of cash on the balance sheet, you buy that business for $10, you take out the $5, say thanks very much. What's the business itself worth? The $5 that's left. So
someone paid... Yeah, so they paid $15 for your business.
Right.
Because after both of those deals are done, again, you've got the exact same business.
Correct.
It's just that one that you ended up net with $5 and the other one you had to pay $15.
Correct.
I've got that run the wrong way. One you paid $5, one you paid $15.
Yep.
It's really useful. It's a useful concept. And that's why often you mentioned EV to EBITDA before. Yes. So like one of these acronyms that stands for earnings before you account for interest and tax and your depreciation, your amortization. And Charlie Munger called it BS earnings and for good reason. But the valid way of considering it potentially is that it is itself an earnings measure that is agnostic to capital structure.
Correct.
So that's why where we might, with the market cap, we have the PE. We take the total value of the company and divide it by its net profit. Mm-hmm. And with EV, we use EBIT or EBITDA, because it's sort of trying to take out that capital component to it. So the real question is, well, what's... Okay, so that's what EV means, and that's why I'd be interested in it. What's a high or what's a low multiple? And everything that we've talked about previously with PE ratios, you can cut and paste it. It's the same thing, right? Anything you'd add?
No, other than just to quickly illustrate why EBITDA rather than net earnings or bottom line earnings. And you've already mentioned talking about taking out the capital structure. The I is the most important part here, which is interest. And again, in the two contexts, if you add back the debt, then you have the interest to pay. So you want to look at earnings before the interest. That's kind of the point of removing that. There's no interest to pay if the debt's been paid off. And the debt has effectively been assumed to be paid off if you add that loan value, the liabilities, to the market cap. So that's why you use that level. Whether you use EBIT or EBITDA kind of is irrelevant. And like anything, it kind of doesn't matter which one you use. And even the numbers themselves aren't of themselves important. It's kind of a relative metric a lot of the time. So is an EV to EBITDA of 7 good or bad? Neither, which is really annoying to say. I don't think you should necessarily remove depreciation and amortization, by the way, because if the company's got to buy more machines at some other point, that is a real cost. So yep. Excluding that, I think, is a mistake. Taxes, similarly, you've got to pay taxes either way. So I very rarely use EV to EBITDA, I have to say. Enterprise value is a useful concept because it does make you think about the debt and the cash. To my mind, the price earnings already allows for the interest that's paid on the debt. So it's almost in and of itself capital structure agnostic. Because as long as the debt can be paid, then the bottom line earnings allows for that. And there's no reason the debt should have to be paid off if the enterprise can carry that debt into perpetuity. So I love the mental journey you have to go on to think about it and think about why a business with net cash would be cheaper than a business with net debt. It makes perfect sense, right? Mm-hmm. People don't often think about it a lot. I've used the example before of back in the day, Myra and DJ's trading on a similar PE. DJ's had $200 million worth of property. Myra had debt. Yet the PE was the same. People say, well, it's all the same, isn't it? It's like, well, no, because there's debt and there's, you know, so it's a useful process. I've never relied on it to value a company. Go on.
When there is significant levels of cash or debt, I think it's more useful. I think it's useful for a comparative basis too. Yeah. And I think it's also, I actually think it's quite useful for getting a lens on the economic strength of a business. And what I mean by that is that we've talked, I'm not going too far off topic here, but you may have heard of things like return on equity, which is the net profit relative to the net assets of the business or the equity of the business. But there's also a thing called return on capital or return on assets, in fact, if you want to do that as well, which basically is saying, well, what's the return I'm generating against all of the assets that I'm employing here, or the capital that, if you want, that I am deploying here, what's the return I'm getting? So you do find there are more companies than you'd think that when you look at their return on equity and their profitability and their earnings graph, it actually looks pretty good, but it's been juiced by debt. And in the same way that if I put a 20% deposit on $1 million house and it goes up by 200 grand, I've doubled my money on my equity component. It's the same thing. So is that good or that bad? It's neither. It depends. They're like, if you're Sydney Airport and you've got all these tangibles, you know, high quality assets, and you can do that and you can do it safely, why wouldn't you do that, right? If you're a services company that has extremely lumpy and unpredictable income, then maybe not, you know? So, and the thing you've got to remember is you can always change it after the fact. That's what private equity often do, where they'll come in to a company with a reasonable balance sheet and just lever it up, take out all the cash and lever it all up to hell. Like, the thing still keeps working, but they've taken a bunch of cash out of it. But so I always think with investing, we always try and sort of build a little toolkit of ratios and formulas and stuff that are helpful. And that's really valuable to do, by the way. But we've got to remember that it's the holistic view that's the valuable one. No one metric or data point is going to be perfect, and they're all going to have their cons as well. So EV to EBITDA is one of them. But I think if you understand what it is it's trying to tell you and you contextualize that with other aspects of the business, I think it can be helpful.
I think that's right. On Kingston, I'm not going to go into detail. It's a resources company, development and exploration based in PNG. Honestly, so it's lost money for the last 9 years and made some money last year. I would suspect the market is betting that, well, either the market is betting that it won't keep making money. And again, thinking about the history, you need to look at the whole history, not just the last earnings. Now, maybe it will, by the way, and that would be lovely. And if it is, you're probably absolutely right. They probably are going to make a lot of money and the share price would be cheap. And there's plenty of resources companies that have absolutely hockey sticked when they go from being loss-making to being perpetually profitable. There's also more than that who were profitable in a year and then lost money after that. And, you know, we'll never see it again. So I don't know the answer to the Kingston problem. You're right to look at it. The key with any of these metrics, though, is to use them based on future earnings, not past earnings. PE, EV to EBITDA, price to book, all these metrics, it only matters the future, not the past. So if this business is going to keep the same level of earnings forever, then paying less than 4x earnings is an absolute steal. If it's not, you could end up paying way, way, way too much. Maybe it never makes a dollar again. I don't know anything about Kingston. I'm not making a prediction either way. I'm just saying that's where you can't just look at the historical data of 1 year and say, therefore, this will be the future. Again, for both reasons. Maybe it's even cheaper than it looks because next year's profits are double that. Or maybe next year's results are a loss and you lose all your dough. So yeah. I don't know. Plenty of investors in Kingston probably have their views. Just tread carefully, but look at the long-term trend and look at the likely future returns. And by the way, if you're not sure about the future, it's okay to give it a pass. Yeah. I'd look at this and go, huh, like I've just said, if earnings stay at this level, it looks like it's steel. Will they? I don't know. Okay, I'll move on then. It can feel like you're missing out. You're walking straight past a fantastic deal, and you might be, or you might walk straight past a disaster. You won't know until time passes.
Yeah, usually you need to be... Doesn't mean the market... I mean, the market is crazy from time to time, but your default assumption has to be you're the one that's wrong. And the burden of proof is on you to say, no, the market is wrong.
Yep.
So the market... And there's a lot of eyes on this thing. Even the smallest of companies, right. There's going to have a few hundred pairs of eyes sort of looking at it and making judgments on it. And a lot of people who are just much closer to the company, frankly, and know it a lot better. Mm. And they are saying it's only worth 4x trailing earnings. They might be wrong, or they might think, well, actually, we're not going to get earnings. I'm just having a quick look through the Prezzo, actually. And, you know, it looks like it's an exploration company. Their share count has exploded over the years because they've had to do raise after raise after raise to sort of stay solid. And maybe they're on the cusp of something that's great. But that's the question you've got to ask yourself here is like, what are the earnings going to be and when are they going to come? And then look at the share price in that kind of context. And don't forget too that you need money to make money. So they might have $10 billion of gold under the ground. Well, it's under the ground right now. It needs to be brought to the surface and purified and transported, and that's phenomenally expensive. So, that's all I've got to say.
No, I like it, mate. Hey, question from Cam, who says,
"Oh, sorry, mate. Sorry, just one more thing. I thought was really an interesting part from Steve. He said there at the end, isn't it all just supply and demand in regard to the shares? And like, it actually is. Like that's it." Like full stop, that's the shortest answer you can give. It doesn't matter how crazy or rational the market is being. You know, the price is where people who want to sell meet the people who want to buy it. Yep. And it's on the margin. And that doesn't talk about anything. That's exactly what it is.
Which talks about the price, not the value, of course. And that's the trick, is sometimes the point at which they meet will be an extraordinarily great deal.
Yes.
Sometimes the point at which they meet will be an absolutely terrible price.
Yes.
Your job as an investor is to either work out which is right or wrong, or simply not choose to play that game if you don't know the answer.
Your bet implicitly is that the market as a whole in aggregate is wrong now,
yes,
but will be right in the future.
which is its own special hubris, isn't it?
That's what you're saying, well, I expect the company to do this. It's like, well, the company not only has to do that, but that has to enthuse the market enough where there is more buyers than, more demand than supply, and the price goes up. Like you can't get away from all of that. I think we can try and pretend that we're a bit more sophisticated than just the chart jockeys and the traders and whatever, by just saying that, look, the market does have distortions, thank goodness, all the time, but it does tend to be rational over time. And it might take a while for the world to realize that Kingston is sitting on a gazillion tons of gold and they're going to make a fortune tomorrow. And if that's the case, then by all means do it. But that's the question you've got to ask.
Just quickly too, mate, I want to add to that, only to remind listeners that very dynamic we talked about is exactly why you shouldn't expect your shares to do well. And in fact, why you probably should expect them to fall after you buy them.
Yes.
Because you think about it, right? You are looking the rest of the market square in the eyes and saying, I'm right, you're wrong, na-na-na-na-na.
Mm-hmm.
And then tomorrow when the market still thinks it's right and still thinks you're wrong, the price doesn't go up. And the week after that, why would the price go up? The market still thinks it's right and still thinks you're wrong. Mm-hmm. And
it's not going to come to the same epiphany that moment that, you know, the day after you did, right?
And in fact, if the market doesn't like it, it's probably going to dislike it more, almost, not exactly by definition, but it's taken a deal. It thinks it's worth this price. So if you think about the way that would play out, I would suspect that if your aim is to say, I think the market is most wrong about these companies, that's why I'm buying them relative to the real underlying value, there's probably a better chance they go down than up almost by definition. Now, you say, well, okay, I wouldn't buy it then. Well, if you don't do that, you never get the chance to buy the bargain. So it's why it's a difficult case. But it's when you buy, you know, we regularly laugh about the fact that we jinx it when we buy shares. Of course, they go down the next day.
Obviously.
It's not a 90-10 thing. It might be a 51-49 thing. But either way, if you're saying the market's wrong, don't expect the market to change its mind or realize its mistake just because you bought the shares. It just, yep, it doesn't work that way. And so you're going to have to wait for the market often to realize, well, you could be wrong, firstly, but if you are right, the market's going to have to come around, and that can take some time, and that's okay. That's how it works.
Yep.
The other thing is, if you say the market is wrong today, don't wonder why your share price hasn't got up tomorrow. Because if you say, I bought it at 40 cents, still 40 cents tomorrow, when you get to tomorrow, you say, it's still 40 cents today, what you're saying is, yesterday I thought the market was stupid. Today, I'm letting the market tell me what to think.
Yes.
Which in itself is its own very special cognitive dissonance. Completely normal, completely natural, everyone does it, but have a think about exactly what you bought shares because you thought the market was wrong, and then you overnight decided the market was suddenly right, and I should judge my investment based on what the market now tells me.
Yep.
That is a special type of kind of craziness that, again, I'm not blaming it. We all do it. But if you think through the logic of that, if the light bulb goes off, you're like, oh, man, yeah.
Yeah.
You'll start thinking very, very differently about share prices.
Yeah, look, and I can tell you, look, we love to tell share war stories. You know, there's all kinds of bad investments that I've made. I'm sure I'm holding more than my share of dogs at the moment. Mm. But there have occasionally been ones that have gone right. Mm. And I can say pretty much without exception that all the ones that went right, even the ones that went really right, they went really wrong in the months afterwards. In terms of just the brutal reality of the share price. It's like you kind of feel as though this isn't so bad. There's got a decent future here. You buy it, you get more excited, you do more research, you get more conviction, the price gets lower, you buy it. And it is hard to do. And then you kind of think, no, but that's what Buffett says. I'm going to do it. Yeah, well, 6 months later, 12 months, 18 months later, and it's still down. You know, like the demons come at night and they really start to haunt you. But it's always a gradually and a suddenly thing with these things. I don't know about you, mate, but it feels like that's... And I think when you look at all of the great winners, if you want to like cherry pick the ASX and you go, oh, look, it started at $1 and now it's $200. Yeah, but it didn't just go and then it was $2 and then it was $3. it was $5 and then it was $3 and then it was $1. And then it was $8 and then it was $7. And it was just... It is unavoidable, but that... I think the only reason I'm hammering on about it so much is I think really at the end of the day, with all that we do, given that the wealth of data and analysis and education and everything that is out there right now, if you're a quote unquote retail investor, you know, out there with your little portfolio as me and Scott are, like trying, you know, against this giant, you know, capital machine, the only advantage, I think the real genuine advantage you can have is one of temperament to be able to sort of say, I will look through that. I will get the big returns, and the chunk of my soul that I will pay will be the many, many months of looking like an idiot.
Yeah.
And it is normal. Now, be careful here. That doesn't mean you should just always hang on to something because it's not going bad. Sometimes the thesis just isn't playing out and the underlying business is not doing what you're doing, and you really need to get out of that situation. But so long as the investment case remains true and you've got that temperamental advantage, I mean, you might not be Warren Buffett, but I guarantee you outperform the market.
Correct.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Mate, let's go to a question from Cam. Ask on Ram, love your show and the down-to-earth not advice that you provide each week. I really enjoy listening to both episodes back-to-back on a Sunday. Makes the errands go a little easier. They must be really bad errands. I have a question for the mailbag regarding inheritances or windfalls in general. If you were to receive a large sum, say maybe $500,000, what would you do with it? I feel it's a good number to pick, as it's enough to change your life, but also not enough that you could afford to do ridiculous things.
I love that.
An easy, unsexy answer is just to put it towards the mortgage, right? But I personally feel a better option would be to even just whack it in something like an Australian Top 200 index and just use the quarterly dividend payments toward the mortgage repayments instead. Or just YOLO it into Bitcoin, I guess, with a smile. A third option would be an even split between the above-mentioned fund and a simple S&P 500, as well as 50-50, so you can just capture a nice chunk of growth for the future. Or would you still somehow stick to slowly deploying it across ASX companies? How would you think about optimizing the use of a large sum of money like this so as not to waste a potential once-in-a-lifetime opportunity? Full on, yep. Cam.
So, Cam, the real key word there was at the end, opportunity, because everything in investing in life, there's an opportunity cost. And the answer is you should, like, so the textbook sort of theoretical answer would be you should deploy that capital where it gets the highest relative risk-adjusted return on investment. Now, that is the most unsatisfying answer ever, but it's the, it is the technically true one.
The most boring answer in the world, but go on.
And why it's frustrating is because, well, okay, Einstein, you tell me what the next best performing asset is. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So for me, and so this is just me, but if I was in a situation where I had a lot of debt, say a mortgage, and that was causing a bit of, you know, stress and anxiety, I think there is a huge return on investment paying that thing down. Even though technically, if I put it all into Bitcoin in 10 years' time, I'd be laughing, right? You know what I mean? Like, it's sort of, that is a personal subjective analysis, is, and it's not going to show up in any cash flow analysis, but it's still, I think, a valid one. Yep. There'll be other people who's like, actually, I've got a really solid job. I earn some good money. I'm actually not worried at all about covering this debt. This is actually something that I can deploy. And then, well, where is the best return that I can get for the effort and my expertise and all of that? And that becomes a sort of a separate conversation. But yeah, for a lot of people, I think we do, as a society, ride a little bit too close to the edge. We love to have all of our chips on the table. But there's something to be said for a bit of padding in life, I think. And even if it's not most purely the economic rational thing to do.
Yeah, I give a boring answer too, Cam. You mentioned 50-50, mate. I think that's kind of right for me. I, along the lines of what Ram said, but a slightly different take or a slightly different angle, is I think it was Bezos or Jobs or somebody, one of those people, talked about having the regret minimization framework, which is simply, if I do these things, which one will I regret least? And I got to say, here's the thing about a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It's kind of like superannuation once you retire. That's the most you're ever going to have. Now, you'll add more to your savings. But in terms of, you know, let's say you won a lotto, you had an inheritance, whatever happened, you got $500,000. You won't get another one of those, right? So your job is to use it in such a way that you don't regret what you do. And frankly, you don't muck it up. At some point, as you're adding capital, you can afford to take more risk. Because the first $10 I invest, if I blow it up, I can add another $10 tomorrow. If I was lucky enough to have that $500,000 portfolio, I'd make it $1 million. Then the downside of losing the million, it's harder to add another million if I really screw that up, right? And that's kind of when you start to think about, you know, the cost. The further you are away from zero, frankly, the more you tend to want to preserve rather than grow, because you know instinctively how hard it is to get that back. Now, I don't know too many people who will, after getting a windfall, be able to replace that windfall. Then more, speaking about opportunity cost and time, even if you were adding more to it, to save that much again would take decades. And so your kind of number one job, I reckon, I can't give you advice, mate, but is kind of not to blow it up. And this is where I kind of come to where the behavioral stuff trumps the theory. Because if you put $500,000 into shares and the market falls 38%, as it did in March 2020. Now, hopefully we don't ever have that again, or at least not for a long time. Well, those of us with cash probably like a chance to buy some shares. But your $500,000 would have fallen to $320,000. Now, $310,000. Now, at that point, if you went, oh my God, what a stupid thing to do, I might just take it out now so it's safe, I'll put it in cash. Now, I'm not saying you would do that, Cam. I'm just saying for anyone listening, as a group, somebody's going to do that. Are you so sure that's not you? Are you so sure you would do it correctly? I don't know. And so add to that about Ram's padding thing. There is a heap of psychological, mental, emotional value. I've said before, ages ago, we've been doing this for a while, mate. We paid down a chunk of our mortgage rather than, this is a few years ago now, rather than investing the money. I am sure I would have done better financially if I'd invested the money over a compound future period. Not necessarily between then and now, probably, but maybe not. But over 40 years, do I reckon that money would have been better if invested rather than paid off mortgage? Yes. Financially, theoretically, absolutely. Why do we do it? Because there's nothing that beats the psychological benefit of saying, at least I've paid that off. Because now, worst comes to worst, I guess, redraw if I need to, or sell the house, we've got some equity or whatever. Just mean you can sleep at night. You weren't worried about, what if I lose my job? What if the Motley Fool gives me the result? What if, you know, whatever happens, I'm okay. And so that you can't put a price on that. It depends on your age. Depends on your family situation. As Ram's already said, depends on your income capacity, all that kind of good stuff. I have to say, And this is why it's hard, right? So me personally, if I inherited $500,000 tomorrow, I would invest it all in shares, and I would probably invest, for me personally, I'd probably put half an index fund and half an individual stocks. Probably what I would do, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about this on the fly, but let's go with that. Now, that's me being an old bastard, having paid a decent chunk of the mortgage. All the stuff that kind of goes with that, right? So I'm in a very different situation. I also know myself. I've been through April 2020. I know I'm not going to do anything stupid, and I don't mean that in a critical sense, and sell shares at the bottom or invest in some high-flying stock that I might triple overnight, and then all of a sudden it doesn't, I lose it all. I know myself. If this was my sister, who I love dearly, who is not an investor, would I want her to put half in individual stocks that she chose herself? Probably not. Not because she's dumb, not because she's stupid, not because she can't do it, but she doesn't have the experience in the market as an analyst. She doesn't know what it's like to go through those gut-wrenching falls and go, oh my God, what do I do? She'd probably do better than me, frankly. But would I suggest it? No, because I don't think that's right for her. Now, I can probably give her personal advice because she's my sister, but I can't give it to you, Cam. So that's kind of the scenario. I think I would, to Ram's point, with that much money, give yourself the permission to be flexible and be conservative is what I would probably counsel most people to do.
Can I say the wrong thing that we should say as well?
Yes.
Have a bit of fun.
That's a good point.
Go to Disneyland. You know, you just got $500,000. Yes. Take the family to Disneyland. I don't know. That's a random example and probably the last place I'd want to take the family. But anyway, my point being is like, splash it around. You know, you don't, I would, you know, don't go out and buy 3 Ferraris and trash them. That's dumb. But you got to, again, money is a tool for use. And I think sometimes you've got to treat yourself.
Oh, that's perfect, mate. That's a great piece of advice. Tim says, "G'day, Scott and Andrew. Love the podcast. Been listening for a while, and it gives me hope there are still some sensible folks that can have grown-up, nuanced discussions exploring alternative points of view, which contribute to a more worthwhile conversation and understanding of the subject matter." Thank you, mate. "This unfortunately seems not to be the norm these days," says Tim, "from many politicians and media outlets, but that's a bigger rant for another day." "My question relates to structuring family finances." Ah, see, this is what I love, Tim. The opportunity to say something your wife's not going to agree with and earn her permanent enmity. "My wife and I," says Tim, "are in our early 40s with a young family," bastards, "and nearly paid off the mortgage after many years focused on extra payments to maximize the benefit of what were very low rates." Spectacularly done, mate. Good job.
Smart.
"Our current plan is to keep the home loan active," he says, "it has no ongoing fees, with a very small repayment and the small remaining balance interest offset. This will give a sizable rainy day reserve available through the loan redraw if we ever needed, but will also be relatively out of sight. This would be paired with a small amount of cash savings increasing over time. We also have a high growth robo advice fund, which we plan to increase our dollar cost averaging amounts with some of the extra cash flow. We're pretty happy with it as it has low capped fees and makes tax time very easy. Is there anything else to consider with this type of approach? Are there any gotchas that we should be aware of? Thanks for your weekly dose of sanity. Rant on. All the best, Tim."
Yeah.
What are you saying, mate?
No, I mean, just so spectacularly done. I mean, it would have been very easy in that scenario to, the moment you got any equity, to roll into another property and just look at YouTube, right? Like, this, everyone's doing it, right? We're making money for nothing here. And frankly, you'd financially be much better off if we're just looking at the historical record. You know, it turns out if I know what ball, you know, what color the roulette ball's going to land on, I'm going to do very well. So it's easy to sort of say in hindsight. But I still applaud it because I think what it gives you is such incredible optionality and flexibility. I do the same. You know, I don't like having debt, but I would keep that redraw alive for anything that might come along. And I would tip any other savings into, you know, we could again debate around the edges of exactly how you deploy that into equities, but I can't fault what you're doing. Dollar cost averaging into a reasonably low cost exposure to growth stocks. Yeah, sure. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. And not to say that you can't judiciously use some of that equity for investment purposes, even if it is another property. I'm not that ideological, right? But as long as you can be done where you're not up to the eyeballs, and the slightest wobble is gonna undo all of that years and years of hard work, and paying extra money and sacrifice can be undone in an instant. So I think you've got a lot. I think you've got a lot of options on your plate. I think you're in a incredibly anti-fragile, robust position financially, no matter what comes your way, even to the extent such is the situation that you could probably afford to be. I'm not suggesting this, but I'm just, you know, you could probably afford to be a little bit more aggressive with some of the access to that capital. So yeah, well done. But there's not much I can do other than some fine tuning, and that would only be in the context of what I felt was appropriate to me, and might not work for you. So yeah, hats off.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump on that out, mate. Tim, you've got it sorted. But you're asking for some thoughts. I'll give you some thoughts just as devil's advocate or alternatives to consider and weigh up. First thing is, I would be inclined. You can always, if you have a structural reason with enough time to do it, you can always remortgage the house should you need to. Mm-hmm. The only reason you need to have a redraw available is if you have an unexpected, large, and sudden need for the cash. I would encourage you to think about we just finished talking about this, the psychological and emotional benefits of actually having the mortgage paid off and the title in your hot little hands. So, you know, you should have a decent emergency fund, rainy day fund. But if I got to a point where I was like, well, okay, I've got X dollars, whatever that is to you, 6 months expenses, something like that, in a rainy day fund, you say, right, that's done. And when I say expense, I mean, you know, essential expenses, not, you know, the 15 streaming services and whatever else. But, you know, if you knew you could pay the fuel, the energy, the food, whatever else for you paid off the mortgage in theory for 6 months, it's nice to have. Oh, again, it's a personal preference thing, right? Do you want to have the comfort of knowing the redraw is there if you want it? Or do you want to have the comfort of knowing the mortgage is paid off and the title is in your hot little hands? Choose for yourself. I would just add, Ram's taken one view, I would add the other, almost devil's advocate, but with a slight preference, I suppose. As long as you've got enough rainy day fund money, keeping up the redraw only makes you tempted to spend it or use it. And I think there's some real value in A, saying it's ours, no one can take it away, and B, if we want to buy the new car, we can't just tap the redraw. Now, you may not, and that's great, but some people will, even though they promise themselves they won't. So just be mindful of that.
I would say, I think that it's an excellent point, right, that you said before, know yourself.
Yeah.
Given Tim's track record, though, right? Like,
totally.
He seems like the kind of character that wouldn't be frivolous.
I think that's absolutely true. In terms of the DCA, yeah, go for it. If you look like the Robo Advice Fund, go for it. You say it's capped fees, which is great, and that's fine. The alternatives would be, again, this is just the alternatives for the sake of it, because you asked, a plain vanilla ETF on the ASX with effectively zero fees. I mean, they have fees come out of the fund, but there's no money to pay on top of that, and they're not trying to give you advice. So at some point, the index fund should be cheaper than the Robo Advice Fund. The thing I would say about some of these things, and again, I don't know which fund it is, which is good, because I don't have to catch my words or whatever, is the fund, the robo advice section may have low fees, but if you may be paying a double level of fees as well. If they're putting you into ETFs that have their own fees, just remember you're paying two lots of fees, which is probable with some of these things. If they say you should get 50% NASDAQ ETF and 50% Vanguard or BetaShares ASX 200, that's fine, but you're probably paying the robo advice for the robo advisor for fees, and then you're paying fees on the ETFs they're putting you into as well. So there probably is a second layer of fees just to be mindful of. Again, is it a reason not to? No. If you're happy with it, go for it. Just think about that double layer, which you could save if you were comfortable enough to do your own thing. If you're not, I've said lots of times, advice is expensive until it actually saves you from making mistakes that cost you more. So if it works for you and the robo advice works, then stick with it. Go with it. Knock yourself out.
Yep.
Ram, one from Francisco. He says, Francisco, and I love the property discussion today. I'm not sure when that was. Relatively recently.
Almost any week there's a price. Yeah.
Exactly. I was going to say that.
It's Australia. Come on. What else are you going to talk about?
Francisco has not been listening to you, Ram. You have been asserting for years that somehow I'm vetting these questions based on positive feedback and all that kind of stuff. He just says, straight into it, please. So I'm going to ask this question because it's the right thing to do, Andrew.
Okay.
Not because, contrary to your skeptical views, I only ask questions where they say nice things about us. I'm just about to apply with the ATO for an SMSF registration, says Francisco. Just your thoughts, please, since I know the choice is ultimately mine. A couple of questions. Is an Aussie tech ETF better or economically safer than a USA tech ETF? Secondly, if you're going to invest your savings at age 60 and keen to include a medical or health company or two in your diversified spread, which of the following would you exclude Ramsay or a similar private health company, similar private hospital property listed company, ResMed, CSL, and or Ram's favourite, starting with P. He said also, is there a glaring health or medical sector omission I made here? That's from Francisco. So first things first, mate, is an Aussie tech ETF better or economically safer than a USA one?
I'd say no, but I don't know. I mean, it depends on the companies that are in the ETF. So let's look at the Aussie landscape in terms of what's listed here. We've got some pretty good tech companies. We punch above our weight for a small, you know, 2% of global GDP. We do okay. Kiwis do great as well, if I'm allowed to compliment our cousins. But
generally not, no.
Yeah, not yeah, yeah, I should, no. I messed up there. Do they compete with Silicon Valley? I don't know. Given some of the network effects at play, given the resourcing they have for R&D, you know, you got a company like Meta that's spending like $9 billion a year on developing goggles, right? You just can't compete with it. So whatever the next whiz-bang gadgetry that hits the world could come out of a garage in Bankstown, I have no idea, but it's probably going to come out of like a mega tech company in the US. Who knows? It's hard to predict where the next breakthrough comes and the industry that grows up around that and who the economic agents are in that mix. It's so hard. But I would lean probably towards that. I think we can call it a center of excellence when it comes to modern tech.
Yep.
Especially with AI, right? Like that's the only game in town basically going forward and it's all happening there.
I think that's right. I would say we made the point on Friday about Microsoft and the 15 years in the wilderness share price wise. So again, and you said on Friday too, mate, separating the business from the share prices are also important.
Yeah, good point.
Now look,
good point.
Fair disclosure, I own a NASDAQ ETF, units in that. I don't own an Australian tech ETF. So my money is probably where my mouth is to some degree. The problem, I suppose, if you're saying, right, you're investing it now and then it's going to be, you know, an investment forever from this point, do I know for sure that, you know, one of the other will outperform the other for the foreseeable future and thereafter? No. I'm with Ram, though. I've said lots of times, it feels like a marketing line, which I kind of shrink from, but these are the companies that are inventing the future, right? Like, there's some cool Australian tech companies doing really cool little stuff around the edges. And it's great, because you're in this market, you're doing a great job of that. Technology One's a great company doing enterprise resource planning software for councils and governments and healthcare. Like, it's been a great success, actually. Right,
yeah.
And great, but it's kind of niche-ish. Versus, as you say, mate, Meta, which owns Facebook, trying to invent virtual reality, or Amazon trying to colonize the world with the e-commerce, the sheer size of these things. I own Amazon shares. I think I'm with Ram. I think the US is far more likely as a group of companies to outperform. I dare say those companies probably end up with a bit more froth and bubble in their share prices and a bit more pessimism in their share prices from time to time. So I wouldn't want to say at this particular point, this is definitely going to be a winner. But man, if you think about 20 years in the future and say, where are the best businesses? You know, by the time you're 80, Francisco, where are the best businesses in the world going to be in the tech space? Probably the US. Will we have 20 years of underperformance? I wouldn't expect so. So I would do that. Again, you can always do both, right? There's no need to choose one or the other. But a very, very, very different set of businesses and very different scale.
Go. I'm not going to be able to give it the proper credit here because I forget where it was. But I read an article recently talking about the potential for SaaS disruption. So anyone who's been investing for a while, remember the SaaS wave, right? We all went to the cloud. Like, it seems so passe now, but at the time, I was like, ooh, what's the cloud? How does that work? And, you know, I don't have to get a floppy disk and put it in the computer and run my software locally.
Like, kids ask your parents.
Yeah, like, there was a time before that. And I'm happy to say I did very well out of that boom. That was great, right? That was a really nice disruption. Industry disruption creates a lot of opportunities. One of the really cool use cases of AI has been in aiding of development, of coding, of programming. Mm-hmm. So where it was once, and it's largely, you need to learn a whole other language besides just sort of having the mathematical mind to do it. There's a lot of developers out there. There's some really great developers that are out there, but you and I, Scott, are not coding up a bit of software anytime
really
soon.
No.
We might be able to though, in really only a year or two, where in fact, there's already some really cool demos out there where I can just say, make me a page that looks like this. And I can iterate on that. I'm oversimplifying here. Mm-hmm. So one of the article was making the point that it's sort of like, unless there's something else to the offering, like maybe there's a network effect because it's a social platform or something, like he says with bias, with someone who runs an online social platform. But unless you've got something above just the value of the software itself, you'd probably be disruptive because someone else would be able to spin up a pretty great version of it very quickly. It may have taken you, and look, trust me, for someone who's built software before, it's a lot harder than you think. It takes a long time. You got to pay very high paid developers a lot of money to make it all sort of happen. When I've got an army of developers who are all excellent and I pay a $20 a month subscription fee to access them, and I'm, you know, there's a million kids in their mum's basement hacking away, like there is the potential for a real flood of new apps in low cost, high quality to flood the market. So I think there's a lot of tech companies on the ASX which will struggle to have a point of difference when they're trying to sort of sell software at a $900 a year subscription, for example, when there might be someone perfectly happy to sell it for $1 a year and just get like that mm-hmm. technological price deflation is a risk.
That's right.
So IT, I think that often have very powerful network effects, and a lot of power sort of accrues to the top of these stacks in a lot of ways, but things move very, very fast. And that's one thing to be wary of as an Australian tech investor on the ASX, is just how quickly the landscape can kind of change. Do you remember Reckon? Reckon before Xero was a great little company.
That's right.
Had
it
a wonderful history.
Yeah, I owned shares at one point, remember?
I owned shares in it. Yeah. And it didn't do well for me because they were late to the SaaS party in the transition. But they were they had everything going for them. Everything going for them. And someone found a way to deliver the exact same bit of software much easier and much better.
Correct.
And imagine if you and I can now spend a weekend with some AI agents building a better Xero. Does that put Xero out of business? Mm-hmm. No, I don't think it does. But for a lot of people running businesses who want accounting software, who look at some of the fees that Xero is able to charge and think, well, maybe, I don't know. The future is in flux is all I'll say.
Correct. And that's always the case. Mate, healthcare is interesting. You asked which company to exclude. To about Ramsey, ResMed, CSL, or your favorite starting with P, Pro Medicus, I think we can assume.
Yep.
I would throw in Cochlear as one business in that space that
for definitely
include. I think that's probably, I'm going to say that is the lowest risk of the five, in my opinion, which is interesting, but you may have a different view. I don't own it, but I've recommended it before. Which would you exclude, mate, out of that list?
I can't give an honest answer because I just haven't done the work. I'll give some thoughts from the hips, but just take them for what they're worth, right? Because you need to have a variant perception to the market. And you're only going to get that if you've actually spent a bit of time investigating it, looking at what does CSL do? Ask the man in the street, what do they literally actually do? Name the different business units, name the economics, name their major competitors, name the markets in which they operate. Like, you know, and I just haven't done that for a long time. So it's going to be like, all I can base it on is they've all got a long history of wonderful wealth creation. They're all, I think, deeply sort of moated kind of companies. I think they'll all be around. So it's a hard one to sort of exclude on that basis. And a big part of it would be the valuation. If it wasn't for the valuation, Pro Medicus, anytime. They got the far best margins. They got the far longest runway. They got the far best economics. They got the far best management. You know, like the most scalable cost base. I can go on and on and on about Pro Medicus, but it's at a PE of 120 or something. You know, it's just like, I can't. So it's a really wimpy answer. I'm sorry, but that's the answer.
I guess which one you exclude that, not which one you would choose. Do you have a...
Maybe Ramsey. Because I haven't looked at it for a while, but from memory, they've got a lot of property and a lot of debt to support that kind of property. And so it's not necessarily, I mean, there's a lot of advantages to not having to lease and the rest of it, but there are costs and risks and everything around that. And they operate, I think there's like big European operations and stuff. Take this with a large grain of salt, because there'll be people who know these companies well going, you're an idiot. What you don't understand is X, Y, and Z. So,
yeah. I would also exclude Ramsey, actually, mate, which is disappointing because it means that there's nothing exciting to say about it, particularly for all the reasons you've said. This is a very large, capital-intensive business. Very hard to move the dial in terms of growth from this point because it's already so big. but also there's not particularly great financial components. It is, well, you know what I love about the question? Francisco's highlighted it beautifully. He's called it a private hospital property listed company.
Oh, there
you exactly
go.
What
there
it is.
Right.
And I think, you know, the what I find fascinating is the things we call, a bit like tech. We say tech, I've said before, there's a massive range of what is really tech, and none of it's really real. It's all, it's retail. Happens to use technology, or it's, you know, consumer goods that happens to sell a product that has a computer chip in it. These companies are very, very, very different, you know. Even frankly, ResMed, is it healthcare? I mean, it makes machines. You know, like, it is a consumer product or is it healthcare? Well, I don't know, you know. Does it help your health? Yes. Okay. What's an Apple Watch if it has, you know, ECG monitoring? Is that a timepiece or is it, you know? And I don't mean to be deliberately obtuse. I guess I'm just making the point that these big, you know, terms, again, putting ProMedicus in with CSL, again, think about the difference between those two businesses. I'm not saying either is right or wrong, but it's a very, very, very broad brush to call them all healthcare. Funnily enough, ProMedicus is probably more a tech company than a healthcare company, and plenty of other companies called tech companies are probably retail companies, right? So you think, well, what is it really? Francisco, I'm going to quickly just take as I like to do, reject the premise of the question. Do you need any healthcare companies? Maybe. Do you need three of the four? Probably not. In fact, almost by definition, you add that to other stuff. How many sectors, how many companies do you need your third best healthcare business? Maybe. If they're three great healthcare businesses and they're all better than every other idea you've got, go for it. If your best healthcare business is your 25th best idea, you probably don't need any of them. So I will kind of just start by taking a slight, or not start
That's
by,
a good point.
Add to that by taking a slightly different perspective. I would also exclude Ramsay for the reason I've just talked about. As a business, I would absolutely exclude ProMedicus on valuation, not because it can't, but just because who knows. And, you know, again, we talked before, was it Friday or Sunday? I can't remember. Today or Friday. Just about the too hard basket. If you've got a business on a P of 120, it's got to increase profits sixfold to be on a P of 20. And when it does that, if the market has to stay flat and you still don't make any money. Yeah. So just by the current price right now, profit might have to be six-ish times, and call it five, call it seven, who cares, larger right now. Now, if the market goes up 20% while it happens, well, you got up another 20% to catch up with that. If the market goes up 50% while it takes that time, then you're 50% behind. I'm not saying it can't do it. ProMedicus, if anyone can, it probably is ProMedicus, given the scalability Ram just talked about. But probabilistically, you know, if I have a scarce amount of money and I want to invest that, my most likely ideas, do I want to invest in a business with 120 PE? No. Again, not saying it's wrong to do so. I don't want to do it. I don't have the required degree of certainty given the sheer mind-boggling maths that's required to do well from that investment at the current price. So I don't know. I might even exclude ProMedicus before Ramsay, but I'd probably exclude both for very, very, very different reasons. ResMed I like a lot. CSL I like a lot. Notwithstanding to Ram's point, can you really get your head around it? No. You've got to trust management. The sheer size of CSL means in 5 years' time, it's going to have to invent some income streams that I don't know about yet. Because it's just so huge. The market can't grow organically enough, given how big it already is. You've got to add stupid amounts of billions of dollars worth of revenue and market cap. Can they do that? I don't know. So you're going to have to trust management and background and R&D spending, all that kind of stuff, and hope they can do it. So that's probably less certain. ResMed, I think the sleep apnea machine market is great. I think the Ozempic risk is way overblown, but it's not nothing. I wouldn't hold ResMed forever. Cochlear the same. If a gene therapy fixes a lot of deafness, the cochlear implant might be one of those things we see in museums in 10 years' time. Maybe not. So yeah, that's hard.
Yeah, I like all of that. Just while you're doing that, I had a quick look at Ramsay just because, as I said, I hadn't for a while. So wow, did COVID really knock the wind out of their sales? Yeah. So I'm trying to piece it together just from the numbers, but I reckon a pretty good guess, and people who have been following it will know if this is right or not, but I suspect they had a massive impact. They raised shares. It looks like they raised 10 or 12% extra shares. There was a big dilution kind of event. And their return on equity, their earnings just fell away. But let's say they get back to their former goal. Oh, the point I wanted to make was this is a good example of when capital structures can go against you, right? Because they did have a lot of debt, which was fine because it was hospitals and hospitals are reliable and there's a super safe source of revenue and blah, 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 blah. Well, it is until it isn't. And it's not to sort of Just to make that point, right? Because this is when things go really hairy for companies that carry a bit of leverage and suffer an event like that. The other thing, though, is with it, you look at it and say, well, okay, maybe they get back on their feet in the next few years. Looking at the forecast, they're saying, you know, $1.50 in dividends in 3 years' time, recovering strongly, they're doubling, in fact, from where they are at the moment over the next 3 years. Well, $1.50 in dividends, what is the share price now? $50.
Yep.
That means that in 3 years' time, if this analysis is correct, I'll have a company that's yielding me about 3% on my purchase price. Yep. So, it's not in 3 years' time, yep. Right? Not now. In fact, it's 0.15 or 1.5% or something now. So, I would exclude Ramsey.
I'm not going to flog the dead horse too much further, mate, but I'll share some numbers. 5 years ago, sales per share of $56. Now, sales per share of $62. So, gain of about 10% per share, sales-wise, over 5 years, which is anemic at best. Now, yes, COVID in between that, maybe they're going to bounce back. They did have a decent jump between 2022 and 2023, so maybe this financial year is different. And again, I'm not saying it's not. I'm just giving you the numbers. 5 years ago, earnings per share, $3.20. Earnings per share now, $1. So, fallen by two-thirds over that period of time. At the same time,
I bet you it was the cost of capital. I haven't done the work, but I'm going to guess here. A bunch of debt, interest rates went up, their costs went up because of all of COVID, their revenue took a knock. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Over that same time, that share count has increased by 10 or 12%, as you say, Ram, and their debt has doubled.
Yep.
None of that is the sort of story you want to find from a business that, frankly, now again, COVID is really weird, so don't draw any direct conclusions from this. It's the weirdest time Andrew and I have ever lived through as investors because it just dislocated everything, and trying to draw any trends for any of this stuff is impossible now for almost any business, right? You've got there's a break in the series, as they say. But that being said, this is not the sort of business you're going to look at and say, wow, it's doing so well, I can't wait to buy some of these shares.
Yeah. And it's why resiliency is important too.
Yeah, it's not so cheap. You look at that and go, well, it's doing a bit ordinarily, but it's cheap, so I should buy it.
I could get behind that if it was sort of like, look, we had this Black Swan event, right? And it's knocked everything around. But you know, structurally, we're still fine. There's still the same opportunity persists and the rest of it. In a few years, we'll get back to it. And if I had this proposition in front of me, and maybe that is the business proposition, but I'm actually getting a 3% yield today with some franking credit. Okay, maybe that's a very different question. At a 1.5% yield?
So there you go. Probably exclude Ramsey. Mate, we've rabbited on for long enough. You've got to go and run another couple of marathons this afternoon, so I don't want to keep it too much longer. Will you come back next Friday?
Yeah, you bet.
Excellent. Fools, thank you for listening. If you have any questions for us, info@fool.com.au. Hit us up on the socials. Andrew is @Sage_Simeon and @StrawmanInvest, exclusively on Twitter, which I will still refuse to call by its new name. I am on Twitter and Insta @TMFScottP, or you can get me on Facebook facebook.com/ScottPhillipsMoney. On Mastodon, I was on Blue Sky these days. I haven't logged in since I got the account, so I'm not sure what I am. I think I'm the same as that. I'm not entirely sure.
Okay.
You're on Jack's new thing?
Is that Jack's all about Nostar these days, which is a whole other conversation.
Yeah. And we shan't have that just yet.
No, we don't.
Until next Friday. Full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.